and welcome to the Classroom Assessment Special Interest Group podcast, where we talk about all things assessment. I'm your host, Erin Riley Lipo. I'm an early career scholar in the Classroom Assessment SIG, and I'd like to start introducing our excellent guests for the day. Our first guest is Valeria Zuninu Edelsberg. She's a Chilean fourth-year PhD student in education at the University of California, Davis. Her career in education began when she got her teaching credentials and taught students in elementary school. After obtaining her master's in psychology, she started working in the Ministry of Education in Chile and teaching assessment courses for teacher candidates. Her current research focuses on culturally responsive feedback for emergent bilingual students and teachers' preparation for implementing formative assessment. Welcome, Valeria.
Thank you very much, Erin.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
Our next guest is Suzanne Abdelrahim. She is a former elementary school teacher and former researcher with the National Clearinghouse for English Language Acquisition. Suzanne helps educators to reflect on teaching practices to improve learning for linguistically and culturally diverse learners. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you so much for having me, Erin. It's nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you as well. I'm excited that you're here. Our next guest is Rachel Rustani. Rachel's experience is in teaching mathematics in economically and socially diverse communities, and it motivates her to support teachers in humanizing the learning experience so that minoritized students have more agency in the classroom. She recently worked with teachers and students in New Zealand. That sounds exciting. Welcome, Rachel.
Yes, that's right. Thanks, Erin. Thanks for having us today.
Absolutely.
And last but not least is Margarita Jimenez Silva. Margarita is a former math and science middle school teacher who worked primarily with newcomer students. She holds a doctorate on human development and psychology with an emphasis in language and culture from Harvard Graduate School of Education. Her research focuses on working with teachers nationally and internationally in supporting multilingual students across content areas. Welcome, Margarita.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, I'm very excited to have you all here. My first question broadly is, I would like to hear about the research that you collaborate on.
Okay, Suzanne, maybe you are the one who started with all this.
Sure, yeah, I would love to share. We're working with a very large school district in California. We have a group, about 12 folks, both practitioners in the classroom. We have a couple administrators as well involved in the project and a few coaches also. We meet monthly with these folks and we work on looking at students' mathematical thinking. So getting, you know, teachers to really engage students, specifically English learners, in talking about math, solving equal sharing problems, and really kind of unpacking how the students are talking about their solutions, how they're explaining their solutions to one another, and going through this cycle kind of with the teachers involved in what it is that their students already know, what are they learning, how are they expressing that to their peers, and really paying attention to the mathematical thinking involved and the language involved as well. We are in, correct me if I'm wrong, Margarita, I think we're in year four of this. We had an extension, so we are hoping to also continue next year. You know, with all the COVID environment and everything, we kind of had a late start with everything, but we are in year four of this project.
And if I could add, Erin, one of the wonderful things about this project is that it's bringing together folks who have different levels of expertise or in different expertise areas. So we have some folks that have the background in working with emergent bilinguals or English learners. And then we have other folks who really are experts in terms of the mathematical concepts and ideas and how kids think about math. And so it's a wonderful collaboration in terms of we spend lots of time amongst ourselves talking about what are the intersections and what we know about how children acquire the content knowledge while they're also in tandem learning the language. So and exploring things like translanguaging and what role that may play in both supporting their language development in English, but also sustaining their heritage language while at the same time developing their math identities and their understanding of these mathematical concepts.
Sounds really complex, but also very fascinating. Valeria, I saw you nodding enthusiastically. Would you like to talk a little more about that?
Absolutely. I am like a new member of this great team. So I have have the opportunities to see how engaged the teachers that have been going to like collaborative opportunities are. And for me, it has been like eye-opening because, as you know, I'm from Chile. And in Chile, we don't have many students who doesn't speak our native language. And for me, it has been like a very important experience to see, especially how English learners or emergent bilingual students are learning in the classrooms and how teachers can better support them. So it has been great.
That's really wonderful. It sounds like very important work and really complex work. So now I do want to turn the conversation a little to talk a little bit about assessment and the conversations you're having about assessment within this project.
I was thinking that maybe, Rachel, you could talk a little about the, you know, that we're, one of the things we're looking at is the math trajectories.
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Margarita. So one common content that we decided to focus on with the third through fifth grade teachers is equal sharing fraction problems, because fractions can support any type of math content that students are learning at the time. So we're using Susan Epson and Linda Levy's book called Extending Children's Mathematics, the Fractions and Decimals Version. And in the first couple chapters, they focus on the equal sharing problems. And essentially, these are problems that can be solved using students' either intuition, because even a kindergartner knows how to split a cookie in half if there are two people trying to eat the same cookie. And it also builds upon students' understanding of whole numbers. So there are different strategies that students can use with their own prior knowledge, their own intuition, their own background knowledge. And so we've been supporting teachers with identifying those different strategy types. And the really basic strategy would just be splitting the cookie or whatever the item is, just splitting it in half and seeing if that works. So aimlessly cutting would be a good first strategy. But as students' thinking gets more sophisticated, they eventually learn how to coordinate the number of people with the number of partitions. So a slightly more sophisticated strategy would be if you cut all of the cookies or all of the chocolate bars into the number of pieces, depending on how many people there are. And then more sophisticated would be grouping those items, either the cookies or the chocolates. So that way, let's say if you have six children sharing four candy bars, and then they decided to split two of those candy bars into six parts, so each bar would be cut into thirds, that would be a more sophisticated strategy because their children would start thinking about the number of people and the number of items. And then the most sophisticated strategies would be either the ratio, which would be repeated halving and thinking about factors. And lastly, the multiplicative coordination, where if students know that if there are A things shared by B people, then the items would be cut into A over B parts. But we use that learning trajectory to support teachers in thinking about how they can pair students during instruction. That way students can teach each other their way of thinking and explain how they're making sense of the problem to each other. We also identify those different types of strategies so that teachers can sequence a whole class discussion at the end of the lesson. So that way, during the presentations, students are learning from each other based on the different strategy types. So it's kind of a formative assessment. Students should solve it in a way that makes sense to them. They should not be using a pre-taught strategy by the teacher and then seeing how well they can apply that strategy. That's not what this is. We're basing our philosophy on CGI, cognitively guided instruction, where we really want to see what the students know and how we can build a lesson upon their prior understandings.
Sounds really fascinating. So how, when you have these strategies that you want the teachers to implement, how do you prepare the teachers in the district to teach these strategies?
We've done a lot of work with the teachers in looking at the trajectory and identifying where their students are in the trajectory. It's not necessarily something they're sharing with the students, like, you know, this is where you are at the trajectory. They're really using that kind of as a way for them to plan, what are my next steps? How am I going to support this group of children versus maybe, you know, this group over here? So it's really used to kind of help them decide, you know, what are some next steps for planning? What problem do I want to give them next? It really allows them to anticipate, I think, their students' solutions the next go around and really getting to know their kids even more, which is something we've been working on too, you know, in terms of math identity and just truly knowing your students. That's a big focus of what we've been doing as well, and how that math identity really plays a part in how they're able to express themselves in math or even approach any of these problems.
Right, because the teachers are not teaching the strategies. It's really based on how the students are making sense of the problem. So the more we look at student work and the more teachers try to do the problem on their own from the student lens, we're helping them anticipate the types of strategies that might come up in their classroom. And the more they give these types of problems, the more their students get better at solving them.
Yes, I am particularly interested on feedback. That is the core element of formative assessment. And what has been really interesting is to see some videos that the same teachers have recorded with the children solving the problems and with the teacher like scaffolding them in different ways. And what I have really like about the way the teachers support students, it's that they really give them the necessary clues for them to move forward, and they wait for them. They give them enough time to think on the way they are trying to solve the problem. So I feel that the way the teachers are approaching math, it's like helping kids develop their self-regulation learning and their metacognition a lot, at least what I have been able to look at.
So you mentioned there was video that you're watching. I'm curious, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but can you think of an example or a piece of an example that you could share that would help clarify?
Yeah, we've seen some really amazing examples of kids interacting and talking about solutions and trying to explain their solutions to one another. One particular example I'm thinking of that we most recently did with our group in March was two children talking about a problem that they solved, and you know, partner A explained his work, partner B explained her work, and partner B's work just didn't, you know, there was an error there. And the child was really guiding that student and trying to kind of recognize that doesn't make sense. Like, okay, explain that to me again, but what did you do here? And so there's really this kind of back and forth between the two students. The teacher also kind of intervenes a little bit and asks some questions, but it really helps guide that student to clarify what she meant and what she was trying to represent in her drawing or in her solution. So the interactions between the students have been very eye-opening, and I think a really wonderful experience for all of us to examine and to engage in just the discourse between the children, and hearing how they're explaining their mathematical thinking and the language that they're using. It's rich with so much, you know, there's just so much to learn from these samples that we really have benefited from them so much.
We also have some examples of kids using Spanish words sometimes, because we have emergent bilinguals videos, and it has been amazing to see some precise examples when I remember a kid that was speaking all the time in English, but she was like emotional at some point, and she answered with a C instead of yes. Like, she spoke in English all the time, but when she needed to say something very fast, she used her Spanish heritage language. So, and it was welcomed.
Thank you. I was going to start asking, you know, we've talked a little bit about the way students are speaking together and the way teachers are supporting, but I wondered how the emergent bilingual, like supporting students in that math literacy as they're also learning, how that appears in these videos. Would anyone like to speak to that?
We were hoping to see and are still hopeful that we can capture more examples of authentic translanguaging, where they go beyond just one word answers, but are using their full repertoire of language to understand their thinking as they're trying to solve these problems. We haven't quite seen it as much as we'd like yet, but that has to do with where we are in terms of our history of in bilingual education. We are coming out of an era where we were English only with Prop 227, and then more recently with Prop 58, we've seen a resurgence of thinking deeply about how we use children's heritage language to support their English language development, but also their understanding of the content. And so we're starting to see classrooms in which teachers themselves are using translanguaging, modeling how you use that full repertoire. But as a field, in terms of bilingual ed, we're still not all on the same page about what is the role of the teacher herself translanguaging. I think most, I'm not going to say all, in California, most schools and most school districts are on board with not going beyond just accepting, but valuing the heritage language that kids bring. And I say California because I do work in other states where we're not quite there yet. But in California, luckily, we're at that point. We're not quite there yet in terms of what is the role of the teacher using translanguaging in the classroom. And so we are trying to be more intentional now with the work and trying to capture examples of what that might look like. Again, not, you know, some teachers are hesitant to use translanguaging because so long in the field, we talked about language separation, that if the kids really were going to become fluent, they needed to have English time. And maybe there was Spanish time if there was a bilingual program, but it needed to be separate. And math, you know, if you wanted to move them along their trajectory of understanding math, we would focus on one language and not confuse the matter with both. The field has moved forward. We just haven't caught up with the examples that we're seeing. So that's part of what the goal of this project is, to try to find some authentic examples of what that might look like to move the field forward and show teachers this is what it could look like to use both languages to support the language instruction. I had a conversation with someone who's doing professional development who was saying, well, but if they're using Spanish, isn't that a crutch? Aren't you like holding them back? And I thought, I'm still hearing this language and we're in 2023. No, it's not a crutch. But that's, and I cite that example just to say that we're still, some of our teachers are still going through professional development where that is the message that's being said. And so I think for us to move the field forward, we have to stop saying that we need to use both languages and actually have some real life examples that we can show teachers, districts, and parents and folks that need to have this conversation about why it can be effective to use translanguaging as a practice to support the whole child, the language, the identity, the family, you know, background they come in with. And so that's a big part of what we're trying to do with this project.
That's hugely important. And I really appreciate it because when you're talking about this, I'm not in California, but I think about this a lot. You work with teachers in the field right now. How are you helping to prepare them to be more accepting of the practices you're talking about?
Well, I was up until July, this past July 1st, I was the chair of teacher education here at UC Davis. And in my former role at Arizona State, I was the director of the bilingual teacher preparation program. And in both instances, we really try to infuse into our methods courses an understanding of, for all teachers, of what it is like to support students. And again, make the space and create a safe space for them to be able to use whatever language they're bringing in, as well as prepare them for the academic realities that we have. When they take standardized tests, they need to use the academic language. So how do you balance those two things? And that's not an easy thing. At the same time, we also are trying to do a better job of diversifying the teacher pipeline and bringing in folks who represent the kids that we're serving. So teachers who are bilingual. But even that poses a challenge because, as I mentioned, we're coming out of an English-only era where the folks that are going into teacher ed right now are the product of that English only. So many of them did not have the opportunity to fully develop their own heritage language because they were limited in their opportunities. So in our teacher ed, also creating the space and opportunities for them to develop their heritage language and feel confident enough to use their heritage language in their teaching. So working with heritage, and here at AUC Davis, we're working with our heritage language program to provide course offerings, to provide opportunities again. And a lot of it is getting rid of the stigma. So I don't speak Spanish 100% perfect. It's okay. I don't speak English. Nobody speaks English 100% perfect. So trying to get rid of the stigma that it's an all or nothing. And again, just like with our kids, saying whatever you bring to the table is of value and we will work with you with that and help you become proficient in all kinds of, you know, in both your languages, but also in your content knowledge, wherever you're at. Because again, you're dealing with these groups, you're dealing with language identity, your language proficiency, but also math identity and math proficiency. So it's complicated in that sense, but also hopeful in that I think we could provide a good model for what that's going to look like and what that can look like moving forward that will then inform what we do in teacher education as we prepare the next generation of teachers going into the classroom.
And with the group that we're working with, we have spent a considerable amount of time on language identity. What does it mean to really know your students and the languages that they use? You know, we view being bilingual as a superpower. And so that's something we've been working on with the practitioners is really kind of welcoming that, encouraging that, allowing students to use their LOTEs, their languages other than English. So that's been a big focus of our work in the project as well. So language identity, also Margarita had mentioned the math identity piece and how those two kind of work together.
I was curious, you said you wanted to find models of teachers being affirming. And you said you haven't found as many as you'd like, but I'm wondering, can you think of one example that you might use or you might tell us to so we could better understand?
We haven't seen as many examples of the kids using the translanguaging in ways where they're making sense. In terms of affirming, I think all of our teachers are affirming of the kids' use of the language that they're using and their process for understanding the content. What we're hoping, what we know we've all seen, we just haven't been able to capture because it's also tricky when you're capturing video because, oh, it just happened over there, but the video camera wasn't rolling or the microphone wasn't in the right place. So it's not that they're not happening. It's just we haven't captured them yet. But we know, you know, all of us in this room have been classroom teachers. I worked with newcomer students. So I worked with emergent bilinguals every day, all day. So I know what it sounds like and what it looks like when the kid is, okay, struggling to understand the content and using the Spanish and using the English and going back and forth and having these conversations with his peer. Like, we just have not, I mean, unless we wire everybody for 20, you know, the 8 hours a day. And I've done that and it's a nightmare on the data end of it. You know, I literally wired 13 students for full days for 10 weeks to try to capture some aspects of language I was trying to capture. It's nightmarish, but I don't know how else it's a challenge to capture those examples, but we're not giving up. We have a couple more years of this grant, hopefully, and we're gonna keep trying to, again, capture those examples of what it might look like. So I think in our heads, we know that, you know, the kids are saying, pues, you know, quizás si muevo este acá y luego multiplico este, you know, we know what it looks like and what it sounds like. We just need to be able to capture it with video to share with others who've not had the opportunity or the privilege, I should say, of seeing what a bilingual child can do to make sense of the content using their full repertoire of language.
Yeah, and I can recall some examples we've had of student work, right, where the teachers bring back some work from their students, and we've seen a couple that are all in Spanish or predominantly in Spanish. So that's been an interesting experience for us to kind of interact with that. But also just, you know, thinking about how do we maybe adapt some of the context of the problems that we give to these kids to make it more meaningful? I remember we had a very long discussion about a problem that presented dividing up a Pop-Tart between, you know, a group of students. Growing up in a Middle Eastern home, I didn't know what a Pop-Tart was when I was a young child. We never ate Pop-Tarts. So, you know, thinking about things like that, you know, something as simple as, what are we using here in this problem? Do the kids even know what a Pop-Tart is or a pie or whatever it might be? So paying attention to the context of the problem as well. That's been a very fruitful conversation that we've engaged in with our practitioners.
I was going to add what Suzanne was just describing, the importance of the context that we use, the examples that we use, that they make sense to all students in the classrooms, thinking in their different backgrounds. And we have discussed a lot about the type of math problems that we should be showing our students.
So what did you change the Pop-Tart to?
Oh, if I would be in Chile, I would use maybe an empanada. but yeah, it depends on where you are. So it's really interesting. Yeah, I have worked with emergent bilingual students mainly on writing. And I see a lot of common issues like the type of prompts we give to students so they can make a short story, or the type of feedback the teacher gives them if maybe they use a national hero from their home country, the type of feedback that the teacher gives them, it can be very different. Like, I don't know who this person is. Or, oh, could you explain me a little bit more about this person? And that maybe details make a huge difference for kids. That's what I've seen in my own research, at least.
It's not just bringing the right problems to the table to elicit the answers you're hoping for and making sure that students even understand what's happening in the problem so they can appropriately respond to them. Yes?
Absolutely, yes.
No small task. Basically is what I'm hearing. A lot of moving parts. Wow.
And the whole thing about making it culturally relevant and culturally responsive, it's a fine line, because you don't want to do it in a way, you know, just turning the problem into a burrito doesn't make it culturally responsive. So, you know, how do you avoid the stereotypes and avoid falling into that trap? So it's more about the culture that you've created and infusing these things. So it just becomes a natural part of, yeah, in this classroom, we honor all cultures and we have examples from all kinds of different. So it's not an easy task to do. We talk about adapting the problems, but it's not, as I said, it's complicated. It takes practice and it takes a lot of consulting with other folks to be able to do that in a way that's effective and truly responsive and not just performatory.
That is a really relevant concern, right? Like, we can't just assume empanada is going to fix the problem. Yes. And so when you work with teachers, because this is a collaborative practice, yes, how do you help teachers understand these constructs? How do you work with them to rewrite some of these problems?
First, I think our teachers, the teachers that we're working with in this project are representative of the kids that they're working with. So it's a very diverse. It does not mirror the general demographics of the teaching force in the United States. It very much more closely resembles the reality of a lot of urban classrooms in terms of the socioeconomic, the racial, the ethnic, the linguistic diversity that we have. So I think, first of all, this is a wonderful group of teachers to be in partnership with and collaborating with, because they're teaching us as much as we're sharing with them about how to make the instruction more effective and more culturally responsive to the students. So I think that we can start there and saying that we're not doing this alone, we're doing it with the teachers, and they know their students way better than we know them. And so they'll call us on it. I think we've created an environment where they're very comfortable saying, yeah, I don't think that's going to work. Or yeah, you know, let's try this. Or why don't we try that? So they're very, they know how to advocate for their students and for the communities that they're serving in ways that I think make for very powerful conversations when we meet as a group to say, okay, how do we move this work forward? And how do we adapt the problem? Yes, to make it more meaningful for the students that we're working with.
That sounds really ideal. And I very much appreciate you emphasizing that you're valuing the teacher's deep knowledge and understanding of both their students and their practice. It's very, very important to me. But I do have a question. How often do you have these opportunities to get together and meet and collaborate with teachers?
So last year, it was once a month. This year, it looks a little bit different, just for a number of reasons. Different factors have played a part. So it's not as often this year. But last year and the year before, I believe, also was about monthly. We even had one of the summers we worked with a smaller group over a summer session as well.
And the summer session was weekly for about 4 weeks.
Were the teachers compensated? Did they volunteer to come in the summer?
They are compensated. All of the practitioners we work with throughout the year as well, not just the summer folks, but everyone involved is compensated for the time they take to collaborate with us. And then also with any of the extended learning that they have to do outside of our meeting time, if they're recording in their classrooms or they're transcribing student conversations, all of that time is compensated as well.
And hopefully, I think part of the model is that we're trying to make sure that there's more than one teacher from each site that we're working with, so that when the grant funding does go away and we're no longer able to sustain, you know, the professional development, that they have each other to turn to and continue to think through these ideas and support each other. So, and I think the group also becomes very tight knit. So hopefully they're also reaching out to each other across the district. And again, this isn't hopefully something that's going to end with every grant, right? Part of the goal is to think about how we're going to sustain the work after the funding goes away. And so I think the community that we're creating is part of how we're hoping this gets sustained way past when the money is has dried up.
I'm wondering, I know that you're going to be writing about the math and the emergent bilingual portion of this project. Will you also be writing about the work with teachers?
That is part of the goal. As with every grant, you know, it's hard to be doing the work and writing it up as you're doing it. We keep saying, okay, when we have a little bit of a breather, we'll get to that. But our intention is to include these teachers as collaborators on what writing we do, to provide opportunity. And we have provided opportunities for them to present at conferences alongside us. And so, again, that's, you know, one of the goals is for us to flatten the hierarchy in terms of they've welcomed us into their classrooms. We also want to open the spaces for them to present their work at the more academic settings that we are part of, as well as the practitioner. You know, we're trying to disseminate across, so the ARA conferences, but also the teacher state level conferences where they can share again with colleagues the work that they've been doing.
Yeah, and we have some excellent examples from last year. I'm hoping we can get them again this year. But last year we had the teachers create kind of like a showcase video of themselves to reflect on what they've learned. And I think that, you know, they're short videos, but so powerful just to listen to the transformation that has occurred over the year. What new knowledge have they learned? How has being involved in this grant impacted their work with students? And how has it impacted them professionally, you know, as they kind of grow and learn new things as a teacher? So those were very insightful to all of us. And I think that that's representative of, you know, that teacher inquiry cycle that we're engaging them in. And so I'm looking forward to hearing more from them at the end of this year, kind of some more changes in their practice.
I think one of the other things that makes this project unique, if I may add, is we're not coming into us as we're there to do the professional development and you're there to sit and listen. And as we know, teachers, we are the worst at sitting through professional developments. We're grading, we're doing 101 things. But oftentimes it's because it's disconnected from the realities of our daily life. And I think one of the things why our teachers are engaged in the professional development is because we're not coming at it from we're the experts and we're coming in to do, again, to try to flatten the hierarchy. It's like, we're in this together to have this conversation. And I don't quite know how this works. And I don't really, you know, again, there's this trust that's been developed over the life of the grant that allows us to be able to come into the room and have a conversation. And yes, we need start talking points. We need, okay, let's go back and look at the standards, or let's go, you know, let's revisit the trajectory. But it's not okay, we're here to do professional development and you're here to listen or not listen. It's a very different model that I think is part of what makes this project so unique and why they have taken ownership of what they're learning and implemented into their classrooms.
And I think the longitudinal nature that I'm hearing is probably really supported that relationship building. You know, it's not a one and done. We came in August, we'll stop by again in December. Do you agree? Is that part of it?
Yeah, I'm happy to respond, but I'm happy to give the opportunity up. Yeah, that's definitely part of it. You know, Suzanne and Rachel, who've been part of this project longer than Valeria and I, you know, they have longstanding relationships with these teachers. They have cell phone numbers. They have, you know, it goes beyond just, again, the the typical I hate to say it, but I'm part of the university system. The typical university, you know, come in and do the PD and then leave. That's not what we're doing. We're also working closely with the district. So we're also working with their coordinator of that supports teachers of multilingual learners. So that's a big part of it too, is thinking about how do we coordinate? So it's not adding one more thing to their plate, but really trying to coordinate as to what are the district goals and what are the district tools that are already there? And then how can we leverage those to help do the work that teachers have to do daily? So it's not one more thing that we're adding, but rather we're helping them think through how do you make these things work together to make your job a little easier, not more difficult.
Right. And I was going to agree with what Margarita was saying. The teachers are really invested. And there was even one session last year. We skipped January and we met them in February, and we did not ask them to administer an equal sharing problem with their students because we were afraid that they were overburdened in the winter. So we tried to give them a step back, and they were disappointed. They said, "Oh, you're not assigning a shared problem for us to all do this month." They wanted one because they wanted to see how well their students would do that month compared to in the fall semester. So they were really looking forward to seeing their students' growth. And they also understand that to become a responsive teacher, it takes years to develop the skill of learning how to respond to students in the moment. It's a really ambitious practice. And so I understand why a lot of teachers might be uncomfortable with that type of teaching, but our teachers are up for the challenge. And so I feel like that's why even some teachers this year, they were teaching younger grades instead of third through fifth. We had one teaching second grade this year and one teaching kindergarten this year. And they really wanted to continue participating because they feel like they gain so much from these discussions when we all come together and we discuss student work and students' language together. So they're truly ambitious teachers, and they're in it for the long haul.
I think that also speaks to the quality of the professional development you're providing for them, that they're that engaged, that they're asking for more to practice with and asking to return, which leads me to another question. You said there's a couple more years. You've made mention that the money hasn't dried up yet. What are the plans for next year and years after that?
We're definitely working on trying to recruit more teachers from each of our existing school sites that we're working with. Like Margarita had made mention to before, it's just very beneficial to have somebody at your school site, or maybe more than one other person at your school site, to collaborate with, to engage in this work with. So our plans for next year are to increase numbers, increase participants by recruiting from each of the current sites. And we have some good relationships with some of the administrators as well, and you know, trying to get in there and meet with them to get them on board, obviously, first, and see who we can recruit from the school site. So next year, we're hoping to increase our numbers.
And yeah, after that is to look for, you know, apply for more grants to help further the work. So as we mentioned, this grant is really trying to capture those examples of what it looks like and co-developing what professional development might look like. Then the next step would be to actually apply for a grant that would allow us to do that professional development. So that is the next step. We want to gather enough tools that we can then use to hopefully work alongside the teachers that have been working with us, and having them, you know, very much along the lines of PAR as participatory action researchers working with us to implement whatever the next phase is going to be.
I mean, it sounds like really interesting work and really fulfilling work as well. And now I do want to keep this to about a half hour. We always joke in the SIG that it's about enough that you can listen on the drive to work. I wanted to ask you before we go, at the end of our newsletter, we often publish the things we've been reading. And I'm wondering if there's anything that you've read recently that you might recommend to our listener.
Rachel, we have been reading some Kahneman books lately.
Yeah, sorry, Valeria. The most recent one that we agreed we're going to start discussing is called English Learners, Academic Literacy and Thinking. by Gibbons, 2009. So that one's going to tie in our discussion about being responsive to students' math solutions and also responsive to students' language. But Valeria, would you like to share some of the other books talking about?
I was also thinking on that last book we've been discussing. But lately, as I very much focus on feedback, I've been reading a lot, and it has been very interesting to read Ernesto Panadero articles. The last article I was reading about was related to self-regulation. And I think that it's such an important topic, especially for emergent bilingual students that have to develop the language at the same time then develop their content knowledge. It's a skill that allows them to keep learning, keep trying to understand themselves, like what are they missing? Is it the vocabulary that they are missing that doesn't allow them to understand a problem maybe, and not the math part? So I really like that author, Ernesto Panadero.
One of the texts we've been using for this project that all of us have been engaged in is this Translanguage in Classroom, Leveraging Student Bilingualism for Learning. So we have been using this text and working together to, you know, talk about what Ophelia Garcia has talked about here, really kind of making space for students' bilingualism and their ways of knowing. So this is, I think, something we're all learning about, understanding, making sense, and really kind of seeing how does this fit into our work. So I highly recommend this Translanguaging Classroom.
And anything by Ophelia Garcia right now is amazing, who's really pushing the field forward in terms of how we talk, giving us the vocabulary to talk about something that those of us who are bilingual have always thought about, which is, it's not like you're two people in one. You always have both languages working in the back of your mind and the front of your mind. So how do you harness that and use it as an asset? I just read an article this morning by Jeremy Murphy called Wearing Policy, Uniform Foolishness in the Public School. Has nothing to do with translanguaging or assessment, but what it reminded me of is the realities of being a classroom teacher and how many things you're juggling. And he talks about, as you're trying to teach content, he's expected to enforce the uniform policy. And, you know, the 101 responsibilities that you have as a teacher. And I think sometimes, even though we've all been teachers, we forget what it's like to be back in that classroom, and that my only job today isn't teaching about mathematical conversations and giving constructive feedback as much as I would like that to be. It's managing the 101 things. So I think that's what that article just reminded me of, that I have to keep reminding myself of what the realities are of being a classroom teacher so that I can be as effective as I want to be in supporting them in their classroom. So
there are some really great recommendations there. And Margarita, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that statement. Like, as someone who was in the classroom last year and just moved to higher ed, it's often so much that attitude of, like, instead of with, we're doing on. And I like reframing it to the with, and also reminding ourselves that their job is so nuanced and complex, just beyond, you know, the assessment that I want to research, for sure.
In this time that we have, where there's so much, I think we're so underappreciated teachers. We have to be those voices now that in the positions that we hold, we have to keep advocating for appreciating and understanding as you mentioned, the complexity of being a teacher.
I 100% agree. I'd like to thank everybody for joining me today and having this really interesting conversation. Valeria, Suzanne, Rachel, and Margarita, thank you so much for your time. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Yeah. And maybe in the upcoming years, I'll see you and your teachers at AERA presenting about this work. Perhaps.
You can count on it. Yes. Yes.
That's the idea.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Gracias.
Bye-bye. Yeah.